WBUR Boston, I'm Wade Goodwin in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Huge indiscriminate budget cuts are slated to go into effect early next year unless Congress can come up with a plan to reduce deficits. Congress agreed to across-the-board cuts in November if a supercommittee couldn't agree on where to cut $1.2 trillion over 10 years. In a shocking development, they couldn't agree. And so the national debt has climbed to $15.9 trillion. This hour on Point, The Wall Street Journal's David Wessel on America's looming debt crisis. You can join the conversation. Are you afraid America is headed toward a financial cliff? Why haven't we gone over it already? Do you trust Congress to solve America's debt crisis? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll hear from David Wessel, economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. But joining me first from Washington is Ed O'Keefe. He covers Congress for the Washington Post. Ed, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Wade.
Ed, I heard you were at the sequestration hearing yesterday in the House, and it was a model of our leaders putting politics aside and the country's self-interest first.
Not at all. It was politics, I think, before that, and it was essentially called by the House Armed Services Committee to try to sort out how exactly the Obama administration is getting ready to deal with the sequestration cuts that are slated to begin in January. But the White House budget chief, a guy named Jeff Zients, turned around and said, look, we'd rather focus on finding an alternative spending plan and avoiding sequestration than actually starting to plan for it. But that's not satisfactory to Republican lawmakers, especially who, on behalf of the defense contracting industry and military folks who live in states all across the country, are concerned that layoff notices might have to go out soon in accordance with federal law, simply because the contractors don't know whether or not they will have to start laying people off either later this year or early next year.
I got the sense that Republicans are hoping to pin the blame for these projected defense cuts on President Obama and get some political mileage in states that have large defense presences.
That's exactly what they're trying to do, especially in the states of Florida, North Carolina, Virginia, New Hampshire, Ohio, places that are home to, you know, contracting firms like Lockheed Martin or Boeing, or just smaller IT firms that happen to have business with the Pentagon. There's definitely a lot of focus on trying to gin up concern there. But the Democrats and the White House turn around and say, hold on a second, remember, this was a bipartisan agreement. Republicans, two out of three Republicans voted for this in Congress, in the House and the Senate. They own it as well. Instead of passing blame and trying to score political points, why don't we turn around and try to cut a new deal?
So if we're playing politics, I guess we're not too worried?
Well, one would hope that was the case. I think there's both a little bit of political fighting, but also some serious attempts to come up with an alternative. And you've heard a lot this summer, and you're going to hear a lot, especially during the August recess that begins next week, that Congress and the White House really need to sit down before the election and try to start to figure something out. In reality, while there may be some conversations and while there are ideas floating around, it is more likely that at this point they're going to wait until after the November elections and spend that roughly month and a half stretch between mid-November and the end of the year trying to come up with a new plan. But you add that to conversations about tax cuts, to other expiring tax extenders, to issues with the debt, and there's a host of issues that will have to be discussed. But I think generally there is an agreement that this is the first problem, because otherwise you're going to have to cut about $55 billion in defense spending in January and another $55 billion in non-defense programs, anything from housing and urban development to the Justice Department to agricultural department programs. All of those types of things might have to get cut in addition to military spending.
Ed O'Keefe, thanks for briefing us. Much appreciated.
Anytime.
Ed O'Keefe covers Congress for The Washington Post. I'd like to bring in David Wessel. He's the economics editor for The Wall Street Journal. His new book is Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. David, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Wade. Good to be with you.
David, there are several theories about the deficit out there. One side says we need more flow. The better the dollars flow throughout the economy, the better it is for the economy. And when the economy recovers, then we can raise taxes and cut spending and worry about bringing the deficit under control. Another side says, hey, we got to cut the federal budget and cut taxes, and that will stimulate the economy and bring the deficit under control. Do tax increases need to be part of the solution? And what do we need to cut to begin dealing with the debt crisis?
Well, I think you point to a very good illustration of how confusing the debate is. It makes it seem like we have to do one or we have to do the other. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke has spoken about a two-handed or a two-fisted fiscal policy, and that seems to be common sense. The economy clearly needs help now. It's growing so slowly that unemployment might not keep falling. That means something on spending, and it means delaying tax increases for now. But over the long run, by which I mean the next 3 to 10 or 15 years, we have to do something to control the deficit, control the growth of the debt. In my opinion, that's likely to include both tax increases and spending cuts. And it will be easier to give the economy the help it needs now if we're at the same time putting in a place for solving this debt problem when the economy is stronger. Unfortunately, there's about 6 politicians who are willing to accept what I just said as a good course of political strategy, even though many of them agree it's good economic strategy.
I mean, I think many Americans see a path to following this debt crisis. You've got to cut the federal budget and you've got to raise taxes, probably on the rich and some on a little on the middle class. And that will put us on the road to recovery or at least reducing the debt to where we can get a handle on it. But it just seems that common sense is impossible to achieve in Congress.
Well, certainly it's impossible to achieve before the November elections. I think the hope is that after the elections that something will be settled, one side or the other will have an advantage, and it will use that advantage to cut a deal that's more to its liking than it can cut right now. I'm not so hopeful that's going to happen. I'm worried that we're going to end up with just as much division and polarization after the election and the losers looking to score points in anticipation of another election 2 and 4 years down the road. But the only hope is it happens after the election. It's almost as if you want to tune out, except, of course, read my book, but tune out of the debate until after the election, and then people can stop talking nonsense because they think it'll get them votes and start talking reality because they take some responsibility for the jobs they've been given by the public.
I have read your fine book. What is it you would like the general public to take away from the reading?
I think the most important point is this is a big problem. It's not insoluble. And there are a couple of big building blocks and everything else is detail. We have to figure out how to slow the growth of healthcare spending. It takes a quarter of all federal spending now. It's going to 33% unless something changes. We have to decide how big a defense budget we have. The defense budget today is bigger than the defense budget of the next 17 countries combined. And we have to decide how much money we want to collect in taxes and then figure out which people, which segments of the society should bear a heavier burden. If we could solve those 3 problems, everything else is relatively insignificant.
How do you view sequestration? Do you view it as a potential disaster in the making, or do you see it as a possible solution on the road to debt relief?
More of a disaster than a solution. I think it's a real symptom of how screwed up Washington is. Let's remember what happened here. Last summer, in order to avoid a crisis over the federal debt ceiling that Congress has to raise periodically, they agreed to take a gun, put bullets in it, point it at the head of the American economy, and say that the trigger would be pulled automatically unless Congress and the president could find some other way to reduce the deficit by year end.
And what was the purpose of this strategy?
The purpose of the strategy was to get people to vote for raising the debt ceiling with and some promise that they would do something on the deficit later. But basically, it was an attempt by Congress and the president to force themselves to do something. Well, now we're 5 months away from pulling the trigger. They're no closer to a resolution. My gut is that they'll take the bullets out and they won't pull the trigger. But if they pull the trigger, taxes will go up. Spending will be cut across the board. The economy is not very strong. It will not be good for the economy. It will be bad for the economy. And it will further erode what little confidence and trust Americans have in their government, if there's any left at all.
A good portion of your book is devoted to kind of the history of the debt issue. Talk to me a little bit about what you'd like us to take away from that.
The The government has gotten steadily bigger over time as it's taken on more and more responsibilities. This wasn't a Democratic initiative. Republicans did a lot of that, too. And now we're at a point where, as Doug Elmendorf, who's the director of the Congressional Budget Office, puts it, Americans want more in benefits than they're willing to pay in taxes. Over time, we have promised people benefits. We got Medicare and Medicaid in the early 60s. We expanded it over time. We added prescription drugs in the 2000s. Tax rates, the average tax rate on Americans has come down over the last 30 years. So we have these two lines that don't cross. And we have to figure out some way to make them come closer together, or we're going to find ourselves in very dire straits as the world's largest subprime borrower, and someday the Chinese won't keep lending to us.
This is On Point. I'm Wade Goodwin in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the national debt and what Congress should do about it. On July 17th, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke warned the Senate Banking Committee about this so-called fiscal cliff.
The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that if the full range of tax increases and spending cuts were allowed to take effect, a scenario widely referred to as the fiscal cliff, a shallow recession would occur early next year and about 1.25 million fewer jobs would be created in 2013.
We're talking with David Wessel of the Wall Street Journal about his new book, Red Ink, Inside the High Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. David, let me ask you a question about something you said earlier. You said the American people have gotten used to a certain level of benefits, and they don't really want to pay the taxes to maintain those benefits. And I think that that's the received wisdom out there. But when I'm not sitting in Tom's seat, I'm a reporter, and when I talk to people and ask, would you be willing to pay a little more taxes if we could get a hold of this debt problem, most everyone says yes to me.
Well, I think in the polls I've seen, people tend to be in favor of raising taxes as long as on someone else. But I do think you put a finger on something which gives me a great deal of hope, which is sometimes in short supply, even in the hope and change administration of Barack Obama, which is when I watched once a focus group that pollster Peter Hart did, and it was a focus group that had been selected to have a fairly representative bunch of people, like there was one of each color and one of each age group and so forth. And I was intrigued by watching it, how much more reasonable they sounded about Social Security, spending on education, spending on defense, even if it affected them, than your average congressional hearing. So what that tells me is that if there was some strong political leadership, somebody who said, look, this is a problem, we are going to have to tighten our belts a little now, at least when the economy gets better, and we're going to do it to make the U.S. economy stronger in the future. This is why we have to do it, and this is how I'm going to spread the pain. I think there might be a receptive audience, but so far we haven't had that kind of leadership.
I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation. Congressman Mo Brooks represents the 5th District of Alabama, which is the northernmost part of the state. He's also an economist and a member of the Republican Study Committee, which works to advance a conservative social and economic agenda in the U.S. House of Representatives. Congressman Brooks, welcome to the show.
Good day. Happy to be here.
You're among the Tea Party-leaning Republicans who came into Congress in 2011 on the promise to tame the national debt. We saw with Ted Cruz's defeat of Dewhurst yesterday that inside the conservative movement, inside the Republican Party, I don't see any lessening of this feeling. And I wanted to talk to you about where you see the conversation inside Congress on the debt going.
Well, that depends on what the public does in the November elections. As things stand right now, we are very much at an impasse. The public elected gridlock. The House is in a position where we can stop further damage being done to the economy by socialist policies, by an unending list of tax increases. And I've got a list right now, 12 pages long, of tax increases that have already passed, some of which became law in 2011, some of which become law this year, some of which become law next year, and the year after that, and the year after that. So if David Wessel wants tax increases, by golly, he's got them in spades.
What do you say, Congressman, to the argument that it's, you know, not good for the economy or even politically realistic to solve the debt crisis with spending cuts alone?
Well, spending has gone up over 40% in the past 5 to 6 years. So that ought to tell you what the cause of the problem is. It's not that there is a lack of revenue for the federal government. The revenues have been going up leaps and bounds. The problem is that spending has been going up even faster. For example, in this heated debate in Washington about spending cuts, in the last fiscal year that ended September 30th of 2011, spending actually went up more than $100 billion. So how can the other side of the aisle complain about us being so conservative that we're hurting so many people with these dramatic, draconian spending cuts, when in fact spending has gone up over $100 billion? There's a disconnect there, and I hope the public will see through it.
Let's talk about tax cuts. You know, paint a picture for me about how tax cuts could help us get out of the recession.
Well, sure. Let's look at the Bush tax cuts. They passed in 2001 and 2003. Let's look at our deficit in the 2003-04 fiscal year. It was $413 billion. Well, in the ensuing 3 years after those tax cuts passed, our deficit dropped to $161 billion. Do the math again. $413 billion down to $161 billion. Now, how did that happen? Well, the tax cuts had the desired effect. We had 7 million jobs created over that three-year period of time. That increases revenues because now you've got 7 million more income generators. It also decreases expenses for the government for the wealth transfer entitlement programs because people are employed, don't need that kind of federal government assistance. So you got a double whammy in a positive way from the tax cuts that the Democrats like to chastise. But it did what it was supposed to do. It decreased our deficit, it increased employment, it increased tax revenues, and it spurred the economy.
David, I'd like you to respond to Congressman O. What do you say?
Well, first of all, he's absolutely right, the numbers about what's happening to spending now. But the problem isn't today's deficit. Today's deficit is driven by partly by decisions we made in the past, but largely by this lousy economy we've had. You want the deficit to grow at times of a bad economy. The question is, as you look ahead over the next 3 to 5 to 10 years, we're on an unsustainable trajectory. If we, it is arithmetically possible to cut spending enough so you don't have to raise taxes. My political judgment is that the American people don't want that level of spending cuts. But the congressman runs for re-election, and I don't, so he may have a better finger on the pulse of the people. Tax cuts are good for economic growth. That's true. But they don't pay for themselves. And we have been unwilling to tax ourselves enough to pay for the spending promises we've made. I don't see a lot of people running to the steps of the Capitol saying, cut Social Security, cut Medicare, cut Medicaid, cut defense. Those are the big things in the budget. And until we see that, I think it's not true that the people really have shown that they want, in specific, those spending cuts. But to the extent that they vote for Tea Party people, they are definitely sending a signal that they don't trust Washington. And it will be interesting to see if once the newly elected members get serious about the budget, particularly if we have a Romney presidency and they have more power, whether the public will be as supportive of it in specific as many of them have been in the primaries and elections so far.
Congressman, do you support cuts in the military budget as well as social programs?
I think that the national defense also has to sustain some of the burden with our reduced spending, but it has to be concomitant with a reduction in their mission scope. America cannot continue to be the police cop on every corner of the globe if we're going to have those defense cuts. And so the president, as commander-in-chief, has to start deciding, do we really need to have as many troops as we have in Europe? Do we really need to be considering whether we're going to participate actively in Syria? Should we have spent over $1 billion in Libya? Should we have two aircraft carrier battle groups in the Persian Gulf? Do we really need to have as many of our men and women in uniform far-flung all across the globe? I'm one of those that believes that, yes, we can absorb some spending cuts, but we do it in the scope of mission reduction, and we start telling other major powers around the world that it's your turn to make sure that the Persian Gulf shipping lanes are kept open. By golly, India, Japan, China, Europe, you need that oil as much as we do. It's time y'all start carrying some of the load that we've been carrying for so long.
Congressman, you're tired of being the world's policeman, but you're going to run up against resistance from your own party leadership on this.
Well, we still need to be an active player, don't get me wrong, but we do not need to be the cop on every single corner. There are other major powers throughout the world, and it's time for them to start sharing the burden that we have shared so long with our treasury and the loss of life by so many of our young men and women in uniform.
Let's take a caller. Jamie is calling from Lockport, New York. Jamie, welcome to the show.
Hi, Wade.
Hello.
I have to agree with the author and the congressman on points that they've each made. But, you know, if we have debt, we need to pay it. You know, you have to raise some taxes here and there. You got to cut a little bit here and there. And as far as military goes, I think he's right. We don't need to be on every street corner. We've already demonstrated we can just gear up and go wherever we want, whenever we want. I think the paranoia needs to stop on that end of it. And so I agree. I think you should raise some taxes, cut some spending on programs, and everybody's got to bite the bullet.
David, the first caller is supporting my point, which is that there are Americans out there are willing to pay more taxes if it will go to reducing this debt.
Well, I think the congressman, I think it's a really important point that the congressman made about defense spending. You know, I've done a number of radio interviews in the last couple of days, and I've seen some people suggest that liberals want to cut defense and conservatives want to increase defense. But the divide isn't that simple, as the congressman points out. Mitt Romney, who's going to be the Republican candidate, wants to increase defense, but not all people in the Republican Party quite see the thing as the way he does. And I think it's important and it's good that we can have an honest discussion without people feeling they're committed to one party or another. I invite you to run for office and see if you can win the race for presidency saying you're going to raise taxes on the majority of people. I maybe you're right, and there's this strong sentiment out there. My sense is that people are willing to raise taxes, but only if they're convinced that something is being done, both to get rid of the waste in the federal government, which probably isn't nearly as big as they think, but also to cut spending. Taxes only, people aren't willing to send more money to Washington just to see it make the debt bigger. But you know, we'll have to see. We'll see in the November elections. If Barack Obama wins a resounding vote, and he actually wins support for raising taxes on people over $250,000, that'll be a signal. If Republicans lose who run on an anti-tax platform, that'll be a signal. I'm not convinced it's going to be that decisive, but we'll see.
You'd agree that there's something infantile about saying, I want this and I want that, and I'm not willing to pay for any of it.
I totally agree.
I just don't think that that's, you know, where most of the American people are, that they're infantile.
I don't think they're infantile. But I think that, A, they're a bundle of contradictions. After all, there's nothing about human beings that's necessarily consistent. And so if you look at the polls, you can find support, depending on how you word the question, for positions that are not necessarily consistent. And I think the political campaigns sometimes feed into that. I mean, one thing I'd love to see is a presidential debate where the two candidates are both told, look, here's the deficit over the next 10 years. We want to get it down to some reasonable level. What are the five big pieces of your program to do that? Don't list me all the little things you do here and there and what's wrong with your opponent. Let's see your menu of options and let's see the other guy's menu of options, and then people can get a clear choice. I'm not sure people have a clear choice now.
Congressman, is any tax raise dead on arrival as far as you're concerned?
It depends on the circumstances. I can't say absolutely no under any circumstance, but given that we've already got, as I said, 12 pages of tax increases that are on the books, those people who want to take more money from families that need to take care of themselves, by golly, they've got their wish. But let me mention something on the tax increase front for a moment. This presidential message that we just need to tax the rich and that'll take care of our problem, that's just absolutely bunk. It is based on greed, it's based on envy, it's based on pandering to voters. Let me give you an idea of what the tax increases would have to be to solve this deficit issue just for this year. If you eliminated the interest on the deductibility of interest on home mortgages, and you eliminated charitable contributions as a deduction, and you doubled the tax rate on every American, if you're paying 15%, it becomes 30%. If you're paying 35%, it becomes 70%. If you did those three things and assume that there's not too much of a devastating effect on our economy, then you generate the $1.3 trillion. Doubling the income tax rate. So I hope that impresses upon people how dramatic spending has gone up over the last 4 or 5 years and why spending cuts have to be a major part of the equation. And yes, you can talk about tax increases, but what the president talks about is a drop in the bucket, okay? The magnitude of the tax increases that would be required to balance the budget would be devastating, and the public just would not go for it. Quite frankly, the best solution is, as much as we need spending cuts, it's to start implementing free enterprise policies that would grow the economy, reduce the cost to do business in America, that reduces the cost for business to hire more employees. Everybody starts having income. That income brings in more tax revenue, and boom, that can have a huge impact. But we're not going to get that as long as we keep electing socialists to the United States Congress and in the White House.
David, your reaction?
Well, I agree with a lot of what the congressman said, that I don't think that President Obama can really bring the deficit down to the levels that he thinks it ought to go and do the spending that he thinks the country needs and limit the tax increases to people with incomes over $250,000. I think he's right, and I think there are a lot of people inside the administration, president and former members of the administration, who agree with that. I'm not sure the conversation is much help by calling one side or the other socialists. I don't think there are very many socialists in the U.S. Congress. There are a couple, and I don't think there's very many in the White House, certainly not the president.
I'm going to have to interject. If you look at the definition of free enterprise and socialism is strictly government management of the economy. This White House, the Democrats in the House, the Democrats in Senate, en masse, not just one or two, but en masse, they insist on greater and greater government control of the economy. That's what socialism is. Now, have they gone to the extreme of being 100% socialist? No. But that is the direction they are marching us as a nation, because they believe that with their intellect, they have the ability to dictate to the rest of us what we can do with our individual lives, because we're not smart enough to do it ourselves. It's much like the president when he says, you didn't build that. Well, by golly, those businessmen and women who have employed so many people in our economy, they did put in the sweat equity, they did put in the capital, they did risk everything they have, and they did build it, and they should be credited for that, not insulted for it.
A difference of view about the role of government in the economy. I agree with that. I don't think the conversation is helped by calling one side socialist and the other something else.
Well, what would you call them? They're not free enterprise.
Look,
there are only two economic models. Unless you're
I think
and then there's free enterprise.
Well, I don't think that's right. I think that almost every capitalist country in the world has a role for government and a role for private enterprise. In the United States, we've relied more on private enterprise than almost any other major country, and that's one reason we've grown faster.
Absolutely.
But private enterprise cannot function without a strong rule of law, without infrastructure, without some of the goods that the government provides.
Well,
that's why we have the land grant colleges.
That's why we have the interstate highway infrastructure. But when you're talking about the government taking over General Motors, you're talking about the government taking over AIG. You're talking about the government interference with the banks. You're talking about the government.
All of which was done during the Bush administration.
It was done with Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House, and it was done with Harry Reid, Senate Majority Leader.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to interrupt because we're coming up on break, but this is a great discussion, which I'd like to keep going. I'm Wade Goodwin in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the national debt and how to reduce it. We're joined this hour by David Wessel, economics editor for the Wall Street Journal and author of the new book Red Ink, Inside the High Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget, and Congressman Mo Brooks, who represents Alabama's 5th Congressional District. I'd like to bring another voice into this rather lively conversation. Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He's also the author of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. Dean, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Wade. Thanks for having me on.
Dean, you say we shouldn't be talking about the national debt at all. How come?
Well, I mean, I think a huge amount of this has been misrepresented. I'm going to beat up on you a little bit here, Wade. You introduced this as a debt crisis. What makes this a debt crisis? The markets don't agree with you. They're willing to lend us long-term money at 1.5% interest. They've not been willing to do that since the Great Depression. The point here is that we didn't have a deficit problem until the economy collapsed. So if you go back to 2008, look at the Congressional Budget Office's projections for the deficits for 2009, 2010, even assume the Bush tax cuts were extended. Deficits were very small. We were projected to see a fall in the debt-to-GDP ratio. the deficit crisis, if you want to call it that, came about directly because the economy collapsed. And the economy collapsed because we had people yelling about deficits when they weren't a big problem, rather than looking at this huge housing bubble that was about to sink the economy. So it's incredible that we both have this horrible economic calamity, 25 million people unemployed, underemployed, out of work altogether, people losing their homes, and instead we're still yelling about the deficit rather than fixing the economy.
H. Vermont is wrote in from our website, and he says, the national debt is a phony crisis. The U.S. will pay its debts by printing dollars, as we have been doing since we started printing dollars. This is why you can't buy lunch for 10 cents anymore. Yes, it causes inflation, and we've been living with inflation since lunch cost 10 cents. There's nothing wrong with a reasonable amount of inflation. It's been working fine for us since World War II. I take it you agree.
Very much. And, you know, I'm not even worried about causing inflation, because the reality is inflation is very, very low. We would actually benefit from having a somewhat higher rate of inflation. We had this paranoia that the economy, we might fall into deflation. And again, there was a lot of confusion on this, because there's not a particular problem with having prices falling 0.5% a year as opposed to prices rising by 0.5%. The big point is that we would like to see a somewhat higher rate of inflation, for example, so that people could get above water again in their mortgages. So if house prices, if we had inflation of 4% a year and house prices rose in step with inflation, well, you'd have a lot of people coming above water. Those, you know, 3.5% mortgage loans would look a lot better. That would be a big boost to the economy. So a moderate rate of inflation we've had for much of the post-war period, it's coincided with rapid growth both in the United States and other countries around the world. So the idea that we should fear moderate inflation, or that somehow moderate inflation turns into German or Zimbabwe-style hyperinflation, that's just nonsense. We have years and years of experience in country after country. It almost never happens.
Congressman Brooks, Dean Baker says it's a phony crisis.
I think that's a phony comment on his part. It's ludicrous to say that the deficit is not an issue. Let me give you one example. The cost to service our debt from FY 2010 to FY 2011 went up $25 billion. That is larger than the entire budget for, say, NASA. That is half of our entire budget for highways and transportation and other similar infrastructure needs. That is $25 billion a year now that is lost in perpetuity. Taxpayers are still having to pay it, but we're not getting any benefit from it. So to say that that's not a problem or not a crisis, I strongly disagree. And to look at history as it's going on now, look at Spain, Italy, and Greece. How can you say that these debts that are unsustainable are not a problem? Look at the impact on their unemployment rate in Spain, Italy, and Greece. Those three countries average over 20% in unemployment. And now, what's going to happen with America if we get in the same situation? We don't have other nations that will help bail us out as Spain, Italy, and Greece are able to help them out. So I think that's a really that's an attitude that I think is dangerous.
Dean?
Yeah, well, Congressman Brooks is supposed to be an economist. He must know that Spain, Italy, and Greece are on a common currency. They're in kind of the same situation as Ohio or his state would be if they ran very large deficits. By contrast, the U.S. has its own currency. We're in a situation like Japan. Japan's debt-to-GDP ratio is about three times what it is in the United States. We could run deficits like we ran this year for the next 20 years and still not be up there with Japan in terms of its debt-to-GDP ratio. Currently, Japan borrows at interest rates that are less than 1%. That's a long-term interest rate. What that means is investors have no problem at all trusting that Japan's government will be able to repay that debt. So the idea that debt is going to get us in some huge crisis, I'm not saying no way, never, but we're simply not close to that. And that's what the markets, people are putting billions of dollars on the line every single day are telling us. So I have to say, at this point at least, I'm going to take the view of the people putting billions of dollars on the line over Representative Brooks.
David Wessel, what do you think?
If we could continue to borrow unlimited amounts of money at 1.5% interest forever, and we're confident we could do that, then we wouldn't have to worry about this problem. The reason we are able to borrow so cheaply is because the rest of the world looks even worse than we are. We are the world's tallest midget. I'm not willing to bet that that's going to go on forever. And I would rather that we put some programs in place now to restrain the deficit in the future when the economy is stronger, so we don't ever find ourselves like Italy and Greece and Spain, which are forced to do this cold turkey. So there's something, I know we could pick apart what the congressman says and what Dean Baker says. There are parts of each of them that I agree with. But I think the fundamental problem is the deficit is not a big problem today. The deficit is going to be a problem in the future. It'll be easier to fix if we start fixing it in advance.
Shelley is calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Shelley, welcome to the program.
Hi, Wade. My name is Shelley Maduro, and I'm a former elected official here in New Orleans. And I'm calling because I think that the focus group that you mentioned earlier reflects the views of American voters nationwide much more correctly than Mr. the congressman from Ohio, is it?
Congressman Brooks from Alabama.
Alabama, excuse me. The rhetoric that you hear coming out of elected officials like the one that you have on your show right now, and I have been in a position to have to bring down the conversation so people can understand it, but in a way that's truthful and honest, as opposed to rhetoric, partisan politics. When you
wait a second, what factual data have I given that's inaccurate?
Wait, excuse me, just one second.
What factual data have I given that's inaccurate?
To call the president socialist is a straw man argument that just
takes diverse. Do you want me to read the definition of socialism to you, and we can get into that?
Well, Congressman, let her speak.
All right.
It diverts the discussion from what the real issue is, which is the fact that we have a bad economy. We had two unpaid wars. We had a prescription coverage that was unpaid for. All those things happened during a Republican administration. And I think, Mr. Wessel, I heard you on Terry Gross yesterday, and you explain this very well. And the journalists today and people like you need to call out some of these arguments that are just fabrications for sound bites and to get voters vote and promote the kind of interaction we have in Congress where we can't get anything done.
Okay, Shelley, we take your point. Congressman, the deficit...
The definition of socialism from Merriam-Webster, and we can discuss whether what's going on with AIG, General Motors, the banks, and healthcare fits that definition. I think it'd be hard to argue that it does not.
Well, you would agree that during the Reagan and Bush administrations that we did grow the deficit quite a bit.
Absolutely. I disagreed with it. Nothing on the scale that we've seen under this administration, nothing that we've seen on the scale that began the last year and a half of the Bush administration, but that in turn is in part because Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid captured the United States House and Senate in November of 2006. That's when you started to see the explosion in our deficit. In FY 06-07, the deficit was all of $161 billion. After the elections, where you have a new Congress implementing new policies, it jumps almost threefold to $459 billion. The subsequent year, $1.4 trillion. Bush should have had the courage to veto these things, but he didn't. But it was initiatives by the Democrat-controlled House and Senate that put us in this posture by helping to increase our spending over 40% in a mere 5 years.
David, your thoughts?
Look, I think that we have to accept that the deficit grows and shrinks for reasons other than the policies that a particular Congress enacts. We had a horrible recession. It began in 2007 when George Bush was president, and it persisted when Barack Obama was president. And at times like that, it is appropriate for the deficit to widen. That's not the problem. The problem is that current tax law will not collect enough revenues under a reasonable economic forecast to cover the promises we've made on spending. And so looking forward is the problem. The congressman is consistent that he doesn't think that it was all the Democrats' fault, and I applaud him for that. But I'm really not sure why it matters who did what to whom in 1999 or 2006. The question is, what do we do now? Do we just ignore this? Do we increase the deficit more to make the economy grow better? Do we attack the deficit now? Do we try and do a two-fisted fiscal policy? And I think that's the real question now.
Congressman Brooks, I know that you have to go and you've stayed over for us. We very much thank you for joining us.
Final comment?
Yes, of course.
The reason this past data is important is because history is the best teacher. You look at the policies that are implemented, you see the results. Those that don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. So that's why I go back and I look at the unemployment rates under different administrations, presidential, different administrations, House and Senate, the United States Congress, different sets of policies, the impact of spending going up 40%, the tax rates and the cuts under the Bush administration, the taxes that we're looking forward to in the future. You learn from history, and you don't repeat it. So that's why I bring up the past.
Congressman Mo Brooks is a Republican and an economist representing Alabama's 5th District. Congressman Brooks is much appreciated.
No, my pleasure. Hope you all have a blessed day.
Thank you. Dean, I'd like to let you get back into the conversation. What's your reaction to what's been the conversation?
Well, again, I mean, this is the sort of thing Congressman Brooks shouldn't be allowed to say that without the media jumping on him, because the fact is people in the media do know the facts, and there's really no ambiguity about this. President Obama didn't go on a huge spending spree. The reason the deficit skyrocketed is because the economy collapsed. We were losing 600,000 and 700,000 jobs a month. We hadn't seen anything like that since the start of the Great Depression. That's not an arguable point. I don't care if you're a Democrat, Republican. If you believe in gravity, you have to recognize the reason the deficit went through the roof was because the economy collapsed. This is a calamity, and this is what I just find so incredible, that here we have tens of millions of people out of work, underemployed, losing their homes, and we're worried about a deficit when the financial markets are telling us, borrow as much as you want, 1.5% interest rate. I just find that amazing.
I'm going to give read a comment from the website. Shea Riviera Collapse writes, I don't think most of us know whether the debt is bad or not. Why wasn't it a disaster at a quarter or half the current size? Why now? They say follow the money, but maybe we should follow the debt. What are the debt alarmist goals? Why are they always excited to trim the safety net, but never the military? David, you want to take a shot at that?
Well, I think the one point I agree with the questioner, that a lot of this is an argument, and I think the Congress made this pretty clear. He wants a smaller government. He wants the government to do less. And that is one point of view. It's not clear to me that he has the majority of the American people with him, but he clearly believes that. If you're in favor of cutting taxes, you have to be in favor of cutting spending a lot, or it's not going to work. I think that the other thing that the questioner raises is that, it's not like there are people who worry about the deficit. Dean and I know some of them who actually are pretty tough on defense spending. One of the things that the president says why he didn't endorse the report that Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson came up with, this bipartisan deficit reduction plan, was, in his view, they wanted to cut defense spending more than he did. So it's good to have it on the table, but it's not right to say that no one's willing to talk about it.
Forrest is calling from Chicago. Forrest, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Hi, Wade.
Hello.
Two points from history. I'd just like to say, first off, at the conclusion of World War II, we had an over 60% cut in the budget with 10 million soldiers coming home. And within that period, we had the markets correct themselves and the economy correct itself within a year and a half of that that happening. And secondly, the conclusion of the great collapse of 1921, which was actually a bigger correction than 1929, the government didn't intervene with any type of stimulus and so forth, and the markets and the economy corrected itself within 2 years. And so from a historical point, it's pretty clear to me that the way to correct this is drastic cuts across the board so that the markets can correct themselves. And that would include military, it would include social safety nets and so forth, without any direct government intervention in the markets. And that's the point I'd like to make.
Thank you very much, David. I've been watching Mad Men, and after World War II, we had some of the highest tax rates in American history, and it seems like the economy was doing swimmingly.
Well, look, I mean, the trouble with historical metaphors is you have to be sure you're using the right one. I mean, there was a huge amount of pent-up demand after World War II. People had saved a lot of money. They couldn't spend it. A whole lot of soldiers came home. They all started families, built houses, and we had a great explosion of growth, and we had an increase in productivity. We're not in any situation like that again. But I think I'm closer to Dean. I mean, we learned during the Great Depression that if government doesn't do enough, you can end up with a lot of misery for a long time. In fact, in 1937, they thought the economy was getting better. They raised taxes, cut spending, raised interest rates, and we went back into another leg of the Depression. So I just don't think it's true that we could have cut our way out of this. I think we would have been worse off had we tried to cut spending. And it's a little strange to argue that just cutting spending now is somehow going to get the economy to grow fast again. I just don't see the logic of that.
Dean, do you believe that we should put our concerns about the debt aside and worry about the economy and growing the economy?
Absolutely. I mean, people's lives are being ruined by the day. I mean, we have, you know, roughly half of our unemployment's long-term unemployment, so we're talking about somewhere in the order of 6 million people out of work long time. Their families are being ruined. I mean, it's really a crisis, and that's what we should be talking about. And, you know, I look at the same numbers David looks at, so I'm not disputing that long-term we have an issue with the deficit, but I would point out that that's overwhelmingly a healthcare story. And if we had comparable health care costs to anyone else in the world, I'm talking per-person health care costs, Canada, Germany, I don't care which country you pick, we wouldn't have a deficit issue. So what, to my view, the argument about the deficit is really masking the fact that over the long term or even in the present, we have a health care cost problem. And I understand, David will tell me, it's not easy to bring health care costs down. I understand. But we should tell people what the real problem is. It's our health care system. It's not out-of-control government spending or even, you know, I think we need more revenue too, but not hugely more.
Dean Baker, thanks for joining us. Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Thank you, Dean.
Thanks for having me on.
And David Wessel, thanks very much for joining us. David Wessel is economics editor for the Wall Street Journal. His latest book is Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. David, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.